This Voice of the Arts podcast is made possible thanks to the Carnegie Museum of Art. You're listening to the Voice of the Arts, WQED-FM. I'm Jim Cunningham. It is a real treat to meet Sarah Tarana-Jobin, who's conducting Der Kaiser von Atlantis by Victor Ullmann, and Karina Aviva, who is directing the show in our studio at WQED's Fred Rogers Studio, just down the hall from WQED-FM. Welcome, and how is the show going? I want to ask you, we should start at the beginning. How did this happen that you're here in the building with a Carnegie Mellon production of the opera? It's a real rarity. It isn't done very often, The Kaiser von Atlantis by Victor Ullmann.
It is a rarity. Thank you for having us. And really, it's credit to Thomas Douglas for deciding on this repertoire and inviting both of us. And we both said yes immediately.
And enthusiastically.
The opera is done now and then, but Victor Ullmann is still a discovery for many people. Now, we're fortunate in Pittsburgh because we have some members of the Pittsburgh Symphony, the Clarion String Quartet, and they have recorded Ullmann's music and are passionate about getting it out there. But have you been involved in a production of The Kaiser von Atlantis before? Is this new to you?
Oh, no.
No, this is... I had actually not heard of the piece before Thomas Douglas told me about it, and interestingly enough, what made this an absolute yes for me and made it very personal was that Victor Ullmann wrote it whilst he was in Theresienstadt, the camp during the Holocaust, where my own grandmother Clara Leichtmann was also a violinist and was interned there, and so that finding out about this piece actually became somewhat of a very important personal and familial discovery for me. And it's absolutely brilliant. So it's a kind of kismet that this all came to be, I think.
And Sarah?
Yeah. It's an amazing piece. It's beautiful music. I mean, the more we do it, the more I find in the score. And of course, that's a mark of a great score. So it's really touching. It's sarcastic and funny in some ways on the surface. It's really a testament from the beyond.
And the story basically is what? There's a Faust element in it. We're kind of making fun of Hitler, too.
Oh, way beyond that. I mean, yeah. Death quits. I'm going to let you take this one.
Sure. Basically, what happens is there is a character called the Emperor, Der Kaiser, who is an allegorical figure for the leaders of the Third Reich. And he decides that there ought to be a war in which there are no survivors, and that indicates no particular side, actually. But everyone is meant to be at war with each other. And when Death finds out, Death being a personified character in this piece, he takes it rather personally because he did not give the go-ahead for all of this killing. And he goes on strike. And people are not able to die anymore. They're able to get killed, but they're not able to die. And I think that that's really the important... the emphasis, in a way, about the writers who were writing this in the camps whilst they were facing their own mortality was not necessarily the fear of death, but the quality of suffering in between, in the time that they were living in this unknown. And so I think that it's really about the boundaries that we push ourselves as humans when we are in the midst of suffering. And some of those boundaries can be very dark, like we see in Harlequin's character, who become very isolated. But some of them are, I mean, beyond what we could imagine in terms of still being able to find love and still being able to enjoy bits of nature or pieces of music. And so it's really a testament to the strength and nuance of human beings as a species being confronted with the ultimate, the ultimate sufferance or suffering, I would say, and what that can do to us.
And Sarah, what would you fill in around the blanks?
Well, it's beautiful. Sort of the moral of the story comes out in the end. So is it okay if I tell them the end?
Please.
So, death only agrees to come back to work if Hitler will be his first guest. And at the very end, there's really a tribute to Bach. And the characters come out and say, teach us never to ignore the yearnings of our brothers and sisters. And, just the lesson from the whole thing. And I think also musically, there's like some hints. He makes references to other operas. I feel there's a little bit of a hint to Tosca, actually the
where she jumps off the parapet. That's a big Tosca scene.
No, where
isn't
they're
it?
Shooting him.
Yeah,
that scene. There's many references musically. I mean, he's a brilliant composer.
More reasons why people should come. On the surface, it sounds deep, heavy, dark, potentially rough, or it's not going to be a light afternoon. But why should people come?
Karina Avriva's staging is brilliant. And it is very, in some ways, like farcical in a way, fanciful. That's what I want to say, like influenced by children's drawings.
The set is unusual. I haven't seen it lit yet, but it looks interesting. It's quite tall in Studio A there in our Fred Rogers studio.
It is. Evan, our incredible set designer, who's a scenic design student at Carnegie Mellon University. This is his culminating project, I believe, for his degree, or one of his projects. He and I had a really fun journey getting ourselves to the way that it's designed, and I think part of his design element was to have such a huge set. It towers at about 14 feet high.
It is very tall.
It is incredibly tall, and actually I realized how poorly I am in mathematics when I finally came in and saw the set, because hearing the number 14 feet and seeing it are two very different things. But it's a beautiful set, and all of our designers have done an incredible job just with lighting and Emma on costumes. They've really helped bring this world to being. And actually, the great thing about the show is that both in staging and the music itself is really quite fun. I mean, the music is is
like
really
think,
amusing.
Like Kurt Vile.
Exactly. And so I found myself at several points during the rehearsal process in trying to stage it, really forgetting how enjoyable the music actually is, and then trying to find a way to reconcile that with the context of the libretto. But I leave every day kind of bopping along to one tune or another from it in my head.
I mean, we've been having a great time, and the cast is doing a great job, and they've really thrown themselves into it wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. So
the singers are amazing, always, at Carnegie Mellon.
Yes. It's lovely to see what they're doing.
We have to hear. Yes?
To hear what they're doing.
Yes, to hear what they're doing. I have a fan group coming to hear your Logan, who appears. What is Logan singing? What is his role?
He's the soldier.
He's the soldier, that's right.
He's the one who falls in love.
Yes. Very
there
poetically.
There is love in this opera. And love overcomes death. I mean, they sing about how love is the one force that can overcome all of this evil.
And we haven't really run down the other principals in the story. Who else? What other characters we have? There's someone. Did you mention Harlequin? There's Commedia dell'arte in the group here.
Yeah, he's really the most human character. There's the Kaiser. Our Kaiser is very tall on top
so
of a tall set. which presents interesting musical, you know, issues with just being so far away. But he's doing a great job.
He is. They all are. So we do have the Emperor, Kaiser. We have the character of Death, who, of course, defies the Kaiser. We have Kaiser's right hand, the loudspeaker, that actually, in the script, it says that we're not meant to ever see the loudspeaker, just hear the loudspeaker. And so there are quite a few productions in which you might not see the loudspeaker at all. In our production, we do have an actor playing loudspeaker on stage throughout the whole thing. And then there's the drummer, who is a very...
chief propaganda.
Yes, she is the personification of propaganda, but in a very alluring way. And then we've got Bubikopf, who is the girl,
maiden.
The young maiden, who falls in love with the soldier, of course.
She goes to shoot him, but then...
But then they fall in love.
Nobody can die anyway, and then they fall in love.
And Harlequin, who is... I think the truth teller and the truth seer of the piece, which is why he's more removed from the rest of the ensemble, character wise. Although he is very close friends with the character of Death, and they play a good game of cards at some point. So.
And how does Death appear on stage? Is he wearing black with a sickle, or how do you have Death?
You have
costume?
To come to see that.
You do have to, and it is worth seeing. Our costume designer Emma has done an incredible job.
Yeah, the costumes are great.
With Death's appearance, and so that's going to be very exciting, I think.
And is there a big ensemble number where everybody in the cast is singing, or do they all appear in smaller groups?
There's some duets, there's a lot of solos, and at the end there's essentially a Bach chorale.
Wow. Yeah. So it sounds wonderful. Ullmann's story is not wonderful. He died in Theresienstadt, yes? This was where he ended his life.
He was deported to Auschwitz in 1944, so he was in Theresienstadt for the majority of the war, and then was transferred to Auschwitz, where he did eventually... his life ended there.
And this was designed to be an artist's camp where there was supposed to be artistic activity. It was a show camp of the Nazis. But they didn't
propaganda.
Like... Pardon me?
Yeah, it was propaganda.
But they didn't... Mm-hmm. Yes, and they didn't like the Kaiser von Atlantis. They didn't allow it to be produced, correct?
Exactly. Right. It got up until its final rehearsals, I believe, and then the officers came to watch one of the rehearsals and understood that it couldn't be presented.
And even they had written like an alternate ending with this alternate version of the lyrics to sort of try to get it past the censors, but the censors didn't let it happen. But we're doing the original lyrics for which the ending was written, which is really emotionally powerful.
And are you singing it in English?
It's in English.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you had a chance to speak with the Clarion Quartet or Manfred Honeck about it?
You know, we just watched their 20-minute virtual reality video about their performance in Terezin, actually. Yeah, we'd love to meet them.
Yes.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And Manfred, of course, is a big enthusiast of Ullmann's music. Now, I want to know a little bit more about you. Karina, where did you get started with your dramatic life?
Oh, gosh. Well, I started out as a dancer. I was a ballerina, as was my mom and my grandmother before me. So I've always been interested in around theater and classical music and dance. And then when I got a bit older, my dad introduced me to plays and theater more seriously, not just musicals, but serious playwrights, and I really understood at some point that I had skills that lent me towards a much more successful career as a director than a viable prima ballerina, and transitioned to the theater world, and I've never looked back. It's just been an absolute passion of mine, and it's sort of how I process the world and events in life, and it's just brought, it's such a collaborative art form. You can't really direct a play on your own. You have to work with other artists and with other humans, and it's brought me all around the world working with so many incredible different artists from different backgrounds. And honestly, I can't think of a more rewarding career path. So.
And
yeah.
How did Thomas Douglas and Carnegie Mellon know to find you?
Oh, well, actually, it's a funny thing. So I've just finished my master's degree in directing in London. And after working for quite some time regionally and in New York. And then I did the course with Thomas Douglas's husband. And so Seamus and I met in London and we got on really well. And Thomas came out for a visit and we got to talking about all sorts of things. And then it just came up and we decided then and there.
And the two of you working together, this is a first.
It's our first time, yeah.
But an amazing collaboration.
Yeah.
And
Sarah, your story. You've been conducting around the world.
I've done a lot of opera. I had the honor of being the first woman to conduct at San Francisco Opera on the main stage. And I've done a lot of contemporary opera. I was the music director of the Center for Contemporary Opera in New York City for about a decade.
And in Dubuque at least once.
Dubuque, Iowa. It's a good orchestra there.
And what did you conduct? What did you remember your program?
We did the Symphony No. 3 by Louise Farenc. That was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She has been on the rise. Thank goodness we're hearing more women composers on the radio these days.
And
Farenc is one that is turning up fairly often. We didn't even know her name maybe a decade or so ago.
Yeah, I hadn't known her music. And Sarah Davis Buchner played Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 5.
Oh, she was over at Chautauqua with us for a live broadcast once.
Awesome.
She's a lot
I love
of fun.
Her. Yeah.
So great.
Yeah.
But you've been all over the place, and you helped to found an orchestra. Where was it? You got an orchestra started, I noticed, on your bio.
Oh, that was at the beginning. Actually, the musicians founded it, and they asked me to be the conductor. That was the Tassajara Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
We made a recording with Frederica von Stade. That was our first.
Great. Not a bad way to start.
Yeah.
And you've done a lot of work in opera. You mentioned contemporary music is important to you. I noticed in the bio for one of your performances, they said that you had at some point become disenchanted with opera because of the way men view women. Yes, the women
Not how I would say. But I would say, you know, the female characters who just go, help me, and then they die. Like, I'm tired of that. So that's one of the reasons why I've been interested in contemporary opera for a long time, because there's the opportunity to have more realistic female characters and more interesting female characters. I mean, you know, patriarchy is a thing. It's been going on for a long time. There's a lot of help me, and then they die. But there are other stories, too, and I find them more interesting.
Well, it's a very important point to make. And as I say, I think in the radio world, we've finally gotten a little more aware of the fact that women have been marginalized on the radio and in the composing, in the classical music world generally. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it turns up dramatically in the opera on the stage there. Terrence McKnight, the host of WQXR in New York, has been looking. He has a podcast about the way African-Americans are treated in opera. They're often treated terribly. It's horrible. Even Magic Flute, the Moor, is an African-American guy, and he's presented as a stupid fool. You know, so finally we're getting a little more. I mean, it's not just sensitivity. It's broader than
well,
that,
it's bringing other voices to the table so that we can hear a panoply of voices and not just one perspective.
Yeah. And, of course, Ullmann was more or less marginalized. He was unknown for a very long time. Now we realize that these interesting composers with special voices should be heard. So you're getting him out there. It's absolutely great.
Yeah.
Anything else we want to share so that people come? It's a very inexpensive ticket. It's here. Parking is free at 4802 Fifth Avenue. You mentioned the quality of the cast is great. The staging is phenomenal. The direction, the conducting, it's all good.
It's only an hour, actually. And it's very infrequently done. So if you like opera or, you know, if you have any interest in the subject matter or the context, it's done very infrequently. So it's a rare opportunity.
You may not have a chance to catch it again. Definitely. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Jim.
Opening night is just a few days away.
Thursday.
Yes? Thursday night.
Yep.
When is the final performance? Is there a matinee on Sunday?
Yep, yes. We go Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then Sunday matinee.
Very good. I'll look forward to seeing you just down the hall here at QED 89.3. Are you enjoying your time in Pittsburgh? Do you live nearby? They have you up someplace close to the campus?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Pittsburgh's been great so far?
Oh, it's been great fun getting to know the area, definitely.
The beginning of spring.
Good. Yes. All the best to you this weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you
Thanks so much for having us.
This Voice of the Arts podcast is made possible thanks to the Carnegie Museum of Art.